Subject tonight is a glorious, amazing, and shocking therefore. And we'll not read our text until toward the end of the message. We will read many other verses before we read our text, but from the text is where we get our main thought, though we will not spend a whole lot of time upon it. Everything else is just leading up to that thought. First of all, we want to look at the ministry of Hosea. We learn from chapter 1 and verse 1 that he ministered during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. All of those were kings in the southern kingdom of Judah. And we see, as you read on there in verse 1, he began his ministry during the reign of Jeroboam the second. Now, he was a king of the northern kingdom of Israel. So from chapter 1 and verse 1, we learn several things. We learn that Hosea would have been a contemporary to Amos. Amos, of course, ministered to the northern kingdom of Israel. Hosea would have prophesied during that same time period. And also of Isaiah and Micah, who were ministering in the southern kingdom of Judah. Again, we gather all that from what is stated here in chapter 1 and verse 1. The fact that he ministered during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah in the southern kingdom. If you were to look at a chart of the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, that would put Hosea in the last six kings of Israel or the northern kingdom. Now, it was a very troublesome time because of the last six kings of Israel, four of them were murdered, and one was carried away into captivity, into Syria. Now, all that, if from chapter 1 and verse 1, that time period would be covered in 2 Kings, chapter 14, verse 23 through chapter 17, verse 6. So you could read that and you get an idea of what was transpiring this time. Also would be recorded in 2 Chronicles 26 through chapter 32. Now, Hosea ministered to the northern kingdom of Israel. And it was during that time that he ministered, again, toward the end of Jeroboam the second and then the last six kings. It would have been a time when sin permeated the land, permeated the lives of God's people. And then if you go down to verse 2, we see that the book opens quite strangely. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. So this transpired at the beginning of his ministry. And the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms." That's a very strange command by God. And then he gives the reason. So he's to go and he's to marry a harlot. The reason: for the land, the northern kingdom, hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So he's to go and marry a harlot. Now, if you keep a mark there in Hosea, Jeremiah used this imagery of a harlot in Jeremiah chapter 2. Jeremiah 2 and verse 20. For of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands. He's saying, I've delivered thee from taskmasters, if you will. And thou saidest, I will not transgress. When upon every high hill and under every green tree, thou wanderest playing the harlot. Chapter 3, verse 1, they say, if a man put away his wife, and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return unto her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, saith the Lord. Verse 6 of chapter 3, the Lord said also unto me in the days of Josiah the king, hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot. Verse 8, and I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. So Hosea, if we go back to Hosea now, we see Hosea is to marry this harlot. We read in chapter 1 and verse 3 of Hosea that he obeys. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Debalam, which conceived and bare him a son. So he obeys this strange command of God, marries a woman by the name of Gomer. Hosea and Gomer, verses 3 through 9, we'll not read there, but verses 3 through 9, they would have children. They would have two sons, and they would have a daughter. The first son, verse 4, was named Jezreel. And we get the meaning in verse 4, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. The second child was a daughter, and she was named, verse 6, Loruhamah. There in verse 6, and it says, I will have, connected to her name is, I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel. The third child was a son, and his name was Lo-Ammi. And we read in verse 9, his name is connected to, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. So as you look at these names of the children of Hosea and Gomer, we see that Jezreel represented God's punishment. Go back to Ahab and Jezebel and for their sin against Naboth. And it symbolizes God's punishment upon Israel during Hosea's day. Lo-Ruhamah means no more mercy. And the last means no more my people. So each of these names are indicative of God's judgment upon the northern kingdom because of sin. They demonstrate or they illustrate what Israel deserved from the hand of God because of sin. Now if we go over to chapter 2, Gomer, the wife of Hosea, verse 5, for their mother hath played the harlot. She's gone back to her old ways. And we see she that conceived them, that is, the children, hath done shamefully. And notice what she said, I will go after my lovers, and give me my that give me my bread, my water, my wool, my flax, mine oil, and my drink. So the reason she went after other lovers was because in her mind, these were the people that would help her. In other words, she did so for her own self-satisfaction. She did so for her own pleasures. So Hosea's wife, Gomer, has now left him for other lovers. That's chapter 2, verse 5. So Hosea is instructed to marry a woman of whoredoms, and Hosea would experience in his own life an illustration, if you will, of the sin and the unfaithfulness of Israel. In other words, he would be made to feel what the people had done against God. So Gomer abandons her husband to become a harlot again, and eventually, as you read on in Hosea chapter 2, she ends up in slavery. Again, all of this is a picture. So Israel abandons God, turns to other lovers, that is, she begins to worship other gods, and what happens? She would be taken captive. She would go into slavery. She would go into Assyrian captivity. So Hosea experiences in real life the abandonment of the one that he loves. So Gomer has abandoned Hosea. She has gone after her lovers. And in chapter 3, and she's in the slavery. And in chapter 3, God tells Hosea, go buy her back. She's in slavery. She has left you for other lovers. You go to the slave market and you buy her back. You love her. And you take her back as your wife. That's the instruction that Hosea receives from the Lord, which of course illustrates the love and the forgiveness of God that God has for His people. What a story. What a wonderful story. What a picture. But it shows what a God that we have. Gomer sinned, abandoned the one she loved, falls into slavery. And God's instruction is, go buy her back. Take her back as your wife. So the book of Hosea is basically a story of one-sided love and represents, of course, the relationship between Israel and God. The theme of Hosea's ministry was the sin of the people and the love and the forgiveness of God. The major theme of his message could be summed up in three words: sin, judgment, salvation, or deliverance. Now we see the sin of the people throughout the book of Hosea. And we want to look at several verses that just mention the sin of the people. Again, we're building up to something. First of all, they were joined to idols. Verse 17 of chapter 4. Ephraim is joined to idols. They are joined to idols. They are connected to idols. Idols has become their life. In chapter 11 and verse 2, as they called them, so they went from them. They sacrificed unto Balaam and burned incense to graven images. They also dealt treacherously, that is, in a betraying way against God. Chapter 5 and verse 7, they have dealt treacherously against the Lord. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord. And as a result, they have begotten strange children. There's a message there. They sought the help of unbelievers. Chapter 5, verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, Then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound. So they have a need, a desperate need, and they seek the help of the very enemies of God. We see the same thing in chapter 7, verse 11. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. That is, that's where they ran when they needed something, when they needed help. They've left God. They committed whoredom. Again, chapter 4, verse 18. They have committed whoredom continually. Chapter 6, verse 10. I have seen a horrible thing in the house of Israel. There is the whoredom of Ephraim. Israel is defiled. Chapter 8, verse 9. For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers. Ephraim, of course, referring to the northern kingdom. They fled from God. Chapter 7, verse 13. Woe unto them, for they have fled from me. They transgressed against God. Notice again verse 13, because they have transgressed against me. And then also in verse 13, they have spoken lies against me. These are the people of God. And these are all the things that were going on. They were hypocritical in verse 14, and they have not cried unto me with their heart. When they howled upon their beds, they cried, but they weren't crying to God. When they howled upon their beds, they assembled themselves for corn and wine, and they rebel against me. They assembled for worldly pleasures. They could find the time to assemble for corn and wine. They could find the time to assemble for worldly pleasures, and all the while they're rebelling against the Lord. They cast off God. Chapter 8, verse 3, Israel hath cast off the thing that is good. They've cast it off. They've thrown it aside. They made altars to sin. Chapter 8, verse 11, because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin. They were like an unruly heifer there in chapter 10 and verse 11. And Ephraim is a heifer that is taught and loveth to tread out the corn. So they're an unruly hog. That's the way they were living. Chapter 11, verse 3. I taught Ephraim also to go, taking them by their arms. That is, I was gentle to them. But they knew not that I healed them. They were oblivious to God, and they ignored the Lord. Chapter 11, verse 7, and my people are bent to backsliding from me. Though they called them to the Most High, none at all would exalt Him. They provoked God. Not a very wise thing to do. Chapter 12, verse 14, Ephraim provoked him to anger most bitterly. They challenge God. They provoke the Lord. Chapter 13 and verse 2, and now they sin more and more. That is, they just keep growing in their sin. They sin more and more and have made them molten images of their siddle, of their silver and idols according to their own understanding. All of it the work of the craftsmen. They say of them, let the men that sacrifice kiss the calves or the idols. Chapter 13 and verse 12. The iniquity of Ephraim is bound up. His sin is hid. So they're bound in sin. And there's many other things. But you get an idea of the condition of the people. Now our text is going to come from chapter 2, but we want to lead up to that in chapter 2 and verse 2. We read of her whoredoms, let her put away her whoredoms, and her adulteries. So she's guilty of whoredom, she's guilty of adultery. In verse 5, she hath played the harlot. We've already read this verse. For she said, I will go after my lovers. So it was with great intent and determination, I will leave God and I will go after idols of Baal. And she did this because she says, they give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. They're the ones who care for me. They're the ones. And she leaves Hosea. In verse 7, it says that she follows after her lovers. In verse 8, she took what God had blessed her with and prepared it for Baal. Notice, for she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. So she took the very blessings of God and gave it to Baal. And God's people do the same thing. They take the blessings of God and they give it to the world rather than use it for the Lord. We see also in verse 10, we read of her lewdness. Her lewdness. That which is lustful and degenerate. Her vulgar ways. We see the people are disgusting. They're vulgar. And we read again of her lovers. In verse 11, she continues in the formalities of worship. And in verse 13, it says that she burned incense, that is to Balaam. And she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers and forgot me, saith the Lord. She went after her lovers and forgot me. It's a terrible, terrible picture that is being painted here of the northern kingdom. We're going to take our text from verse 14. But if you just put your hand over that verse. Don't look at it. Just put your hand over it. And just look at the first word. Again, this is in view of everything that has been said. Therefore. Therefore. Referring back to what has been previously stated in chapter 2. And what follows the therefore is the reason that has been previously stated in chapter 2. Again, leading up to this therefore, you have a record of Israel's sin. You have a record of sin. Israel's guilt is blatant. It's blatant. It's clear. And God's wrath and God's punishment is justified and irrefutable. So leading up to that, therefore, you have a blackness. Now you would expect, following that, therefore, that you would read something like, I will forget you. Remember, they said, they forgot God. Therefore, I will forget you. But that's not what it says. Or you would expect it to say, I will abandon you. I will leave you. What follows the therefore is not what you would consider to be a normal response. What follows is not what you would expect. You've looked, he's chapter 2, he gives us the record of Israel's sin. And just like one who abandons their spouse, and he says, therefore, what do you expect to follow that therefore? Not something good. Therefore. But what follows is glorious. What follows is shocking. What follows is amazing. The very next word after therefore is the word behold. Therefore, behold. Now, if chapter 2 is your description or our description, and then we come to therefore, behold, it's probably not something you really want to behold, considering the picture that's been painted leading up to. Therefore, behold. It's a verb. It's something we do. It's active voice, which indicates that it's something that we can do, and it is in the imperative mood, which means it's a command. Therefore, behold. Again, the word behold is a word that is used when something extraordinary and momentous is about to be presented to our attention. It is a word of exclamation. It is a word of wonder. Therefore, behold. It is a call to ponder what is going to follow. It is a call to observe what is going to follow. It is a call to meditate upon what is going to follow. Give serious thought to it. And give it very careful consideration. It is a call to see. Behold. What follows that behold? We're to see it. We're to know it. It's to have an impact upon us. And then notice the next word. It's therefore behold I. Behold I. I, of course, is God. And I is the reason. I is the cause of what follows. There is no other reason for what follows. There is no other cause for what follows. Therefore, behold, I will. And what follows is beyond amazing. Behold, I. What follows, there is no reason for what follows in the people. Nothing can be attributed to them. We've already seen the black picture that has been painted of them. But there is a reason for what follows. And the reason is I. The reason is God. That's the reason. Again, behold, I. That reason, which is God, will override all others. It overrides everything. Behold, I. God turns reasons that are against us. Everything up to this verse is against Israel. Everything. It's a black picture. And God turns the reasons against us into reasons for us. But again, the basis is I. And behold, I. So we come to therefore. It follows the darkness that has been described of Israel's sin. Therefore. And if you were not to read any further, you would expect even greater darkness to follow the therefore. You have abandoned me, God is saying. You have forgotten me. You have played the harlot. You have been unfaithful to me. Therefore, behold I. That's scary. I mean, if you don't read on, that's a scary thought. Well, you can only imagine what follows. I will destroy you. That's what you would expect. That's not what it says. And again, what follows is beyond human reason. It baffles the human mind. And it is proof of Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. What follows this, therefore, proves it. It proves it. Reading what leads up to our text, and then we have that word, therefore, ought to cause us to tremble. If you just followed it out logically. In their blackest darkness and most corrupt and vile condition, God, who could have crushed them into eternal doom and would have been right in doing so, notice what he says, I will allure her. Your sin is black. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. It's not I will drive her. It is not even I will draw her. And it certainly is not I will drag her. I will allure. I will win her over, is what God is saying. Her sin is black. I will win her over. The fact that you and I have to be allured by God is shameful. The fact that God has to win over you and I is shameful. But the fact that He's willing to do so is grace. That's grace. That's mercy. That's the love of God. There are a lot of forces that try to keep you and I away from God. But the allurement of His love surpasses in power all other forces. Therefore will I destroy her. That's what we would expect to read. But it says, therefore I will allure her. It's the allurement of His love. And the allurement of that love even overcomes our will to resist. In Israel here, their will was to resist God. But His alluring of her would overcome her will to resist. And it goes on to say, and bring her into the wilderness. I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness. I believe what God is saying there is, I will cause Israel. I will cause her. I will allure her. I will cause her to be alone with me. Just me and her. Is not that what God does when He brings back a sinner? It's exactly what He does. He brings us to a place where we're alone with God. I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness. Not to destroy her. Not to merely punish her. But notice what it says. And speak comfortably. Pleasantly unto her. That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. You read everything leading up to that verse. Blackness of sin, they have forgotten God. They have played the harlot. And He says, therefore, because they've done this, I will allure her into the wilderness and kill her. No, that's what we would expect. And I will speak comfortably to her. This is amazing. This is the grace of God. Therefore, it relates back to the blackness. It relates back to the shamefulness, the despicable, and the reprehensible sin of Israel. And notice what he goes on to say. Verse 15, "And I will give her her vineyards from thence. I will allure her. I will bring her into the wilderness. I will speak comfortably to her." That is in the context of they have forgotten God. They have abandoned God. "And I will give her vineyards." You would expect it to say, "I will take away her vineyards." "I will give her vineyards and the valley of Achor for a door of hope." I will give her hope. This is grace. How can anybody be upset about grace? It is beyond me. "And she shall sing there in the wilderness." She shall sing there. That's joyful. "As in the days of her youth. As in the days before she left." In other words, I will restore her. "As in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishai." That is, my husband. My husband. "And shalt call me no more Baali," meaning my Lord. In other words, I'm more than your master. I'm your husband. Big difference. So, verse 14, therefore. And if you were to read beginning from verse 1 of chapter 2 down through verse 14, and then you take everything else that's been said concerning Israel's sin, because all that was going on, what do you expect to read after "therefore, behold I"? Not what you read. But that's grace. That is the God of grace. Therefore. It's what follows is glorious, it's amazing, and it's shocking. But is it not what the Lord has done for every one of us that are saved? It's exactly what He did. And how many times He's done it since we've been saved. Our sins have been black, and God is gracious to us. So verse 14 is a testimony to the wonder, the glory, the goodness of God. And that should impact our lives. That should motivate us. I don't know what other motivation you could possibly need than the grace of God. There's a verse, I can't place where it is right now. It's in one of the Old Testament minor prophets. We ought to be glad that God is not man. God is not man. Oh, how thankful. Because a wife leaves her husband, or a husband leaves her wife, most of the time, they ain't taking them back. They're not taking them back. We've done far, far, far worse. And God takes us back. And you get over to chapter 14 and you see that He would heal her backsliding. Never give up. Someone goes astray, don't give up. As long as they've got breath, God can bring them back. And how many times He's brought us back. So So that's a wonderful, wonderful therefore that we find there in the book of Hosea. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us.